The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, drug policy, HIV, and health. The High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development is the central United Nations platform for the follow-up and review of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and its 17 Sustainable Development Goals. HLPF 2025 was held the 14th through the 23rd of July in New York. A number of side events were held at the HLPF. One of those side events, held July 17th, was entitled Evidence and Science-Based Approaches in Drug Policy, HIV, and Health, Good Practices and Windows of Opportunity. Let's hear some presentations from that event. First, here's Anton Basenko, Executive Director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs.
I speak on behalf of International Network of People Who Use Drugs, and also as someone who has survived the realities behind the policies we are discussing. I began using drugs when I was 14. I injected for the first time at 16. I received my first clean needle when harm reduction programs finally appeared in my country, in Ukraine, when I was 23. And at the same year, I was diagnosed with both HIV and hepatitis C. I waited 712 days to access antiretroviral therapy. I waited over 13 years for hepatitis C treatment. I survived 6 overdoses. I was denied medical care 3 times, lost 2 jobs because of my status, and narrowly avoided prison on 4 occasions. I lost close friends to preventable illnesses and criminalization, and still, I was one of the lucky ones. These aren't statistics. They are human cost of failing to put people, not politics, at the center of drug policy. I still recall the day a young friend and community member died of an overdose, alone and afraid, because the nearest harm reduction service had shut down. As someone who has lived through the fear and stigma of criminalization, I know firsthand how punitive laws turn health issues into life or death struggles. In my own life, every encounter with police or barriers to care has driven me and others underground. This personal experience reminds us why drug policy must be rooted in human rights and real-world evidence, not in fear or ideology. Our recent input survey in April 2025 confirms what our hearts already know. Criminalization and lack of support are crushing our communities. In just 12 days of data collection, 101 respondents, 65% from community-led organizations in low and middle-income countries, reported severe disruptions to essential services. Nearly two-thirds, 63%, said that withdrawal of funding had a significant to severe impact on their ability to stay afloat. Almost half lost from 26 to 100% of their budgets overnight, forcing clinics to close, outreach to stop, and peer educators to lose their jobs. The human cost is already evident. 46% of all respondents say people are forced to turn to underground sources for clean syringes and naloxone, and 30% report an increase in overdose death in their communities. Each of these statistics is a stark warning. Years of progress against HIV, hepatitis C, and overdose are unraveling right before our eyes today. This data is backed by decades of research. We know that outside an evidence-based framework, criminalizing drugs has devastating consequences. Criminal laws put people who use drugs at 35 times higher risk of HIV infection than the general population. Globally, today, 152 countries still criminalize possession of even small amounts of drugs, driving users away from healthcare and into the shadows. These punitive laws are in abstract numbers. They mean that people who need syringe exchange, opioid agonist therapy, or even emergency care face arrest or denial of services. As our survey respondents noted, community members are being denied or excluded from essential services simply because they use drugs. This is not only cruel, it is unscientific. No major health or human rights body recommends it. At harm reduction conference 25 in Bogota recently, I said we are not a burden, we are the evidence. We are not the problem, we are the frontline solution. And that message remains true here today in this UN room as we talk about how to reach the sustainable development goals as well. SDG 3 will not be achieved if people who use drugs are dying in back alleys and prisons. SDG 5 will not be achieved if women who use drugs are criminalized, sterilized, or turned away from care. SDG 16 will not be achieved if police violence and punitive drug laws remain the first point of contact between us and the state. To turn the tide, we need bold policy reforms. First, decriminalize drug use and possession. Removing criminal penalties is the critical legal reform for public health. Evidence shows that decriminalization reduces HIV infections and saves lives. Modeling suggests averting one-third to one-half of new infections among sex workers, for example. It's time governments acted. Key Population Network demand that decriminalization be at the heart of any effective HIV and health strategy. Only by taking the threat of arrest off the table can people who use drugs seek help and practice safe reuse without fear. Second, recognize and fund community-led organizations as equal partners. As our survey makes clear, the majority of frontline services today are run by peers and grassroots groups. Yet these groups operate on shoestring budgets. Communities deliver results, but chronic underfunding and rigid grant rules keep them from scaling up. We urge donors and governments to prioritize core and flexible funding for drug users networks. Trust these organizations with resources, not just as implementers, but as a strategic partners. This means fair remuneration for peer outreach, less punitive grant conditions, no more punishing results-only funding, and long-term investment in our infrastructure. In the words of many in our community, lip service to organizations have equitable budgets and real power in decision-making. Third, repeal punitive and discriminatory laws that block health access. We need an end to laws that drive people into the streets. Stop and search. Compulsory detention treatment, age, old, vagrancy, or morality laws that target drug users. Every country with harmful drug laws is a lost opportunity to curb HIV and hepatitis. INPUT and other Global Key Population Network position paper reminds us that criminalization, stigma, and anti-rights movements all undermine public health. Governments must roll back laws that ban needle exchange, that detain pregnant people who use drugs, or that stigmatize those who test positive for HIV or hepatitis C. We must integrate healthcare with dignity. As our survey respondents reported, cutting harm reduction has already caused fatal outcomes. Imagine the lives saved if instead we invested in compassionate care from the start. And finally, put people who use drugs in the driver's seat. We are the ones who know these problems inside and out. Every policy, every program should include us meaningfully at every stage. This means representation on national drug commissions and health planning committees. But more importantly, it means power sharing, actual decision-making authority, not just talking consultations. The path to ending HIV and improving health for all is to value the expertise of people who use drugs alongside scientists and clinicians. We ask UN agencies, member states, and donors, center us, listen to us, fund us as equals. The position paper's vision of communities at the center isn't abstract. Is the only way to ensure policies work on the ground. And in closing, I call on governments, donors, and UN bodies to act on these facts and values now, right now. The data is clear, and the moral choice is clear. Prioritize human life, community leadership, and justice in global drug policy. The question is not if we will act, but how urgently we will begin. Let's not wait for more lives to be lost. Let's to build a future people who use drugs don't just survive, we lead, we thrive, and we are no longer punished for being who we are.
That was Anton Basenko, executive director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs, speaking at a side event entitled Evidence and Science-Based Approaches in Drug Policy, HIV and Health, Good Practices and Windows of Opportunity, which was held July 17th during the High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development at the United Nations in New York. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear more. Jindřich Vobral is a leading expert on drug use and formerly the National Drug Coordinator of the Czech Republic.
Okay, thank you, Chair, for giving me the floor. Dear Excellencies, dear participants, let me first congratulate you for putting such important meeting together. I would like to start with some reflection on Czech drug policy. You might know that Czech Republic is one of the 8 countries that repeatedly reporting less than 1% of HIV among injecting drug users, still remains the same last 20 years. So I would say we might have done something right when the revolution started happened in 1989, the country was almost broke economically, and the drug problem started rising because the Iron Curtain fell. But at that point, we decided to reverse our policies to the usual based usual policies, because usually the policies are based on the idea of abstinence. Abstinence is the prime goal. So we reversed it and said, okay, the country doesn't have so much money. We need to find some very practical solutions. And then we decided and slowly slowly defined our policy as based on harm reduction, where abstinence is part of the solution, but not the only option, not the only choice. When we talk about harm reduction policy, we talk about the policy approach, not harm reduction strategies, not harm reduction interventions. We talk about harm reduction policy. And what does it mean for us? It means legislation, starts with legislation. So as the predecessor speaker said, it's decriminalization. This is a must. We decriminalized the possession for personal use at the end of 90s. And then the following government reversed it back to criminalization, but at the same time, they launched a study to see that government launched a study to see what is happening with the effects of the law. And the effects became worse and worse. So 2010, we decided to go back to decriminalization. So this is one of the key possibilities, as Anton before me said, for people who use drugs to actually access any kind of service without being stigmatized or approaching problems. So that proved to be a policy, even not to in terms of people who use drugs, but also in terms of organized crime and security actually is maintained, and is probably similar to Switzerland and other countries experience the same. If you come with a harm reduction approach policy, you realize that organized crime doesn't have enough food to feed on. The other area is of course budget and financial mechanisms, as Anton also mentioned before me. Without money, you can speak about policy, you can design policies, you can have nice papers, we can have nice conferences, but nothing happens in the field at the end for the people who are suffering or are in vulnerable situation. We, in country of 10 million people, managed to establish 160 let's say, harm reduction intervention type community centers, so it's accessible to every citizen in the country. And I think this is one of the key issues why people have no HIV among injecting drug users in the Czech Republic. These two main, the main, the two main kind of pillars of our policy. Another area that we are trying to push for is something that we call substituted market. We decided and designed a new law, psychomodulatory substances, we call it, when we say let's regulate substances which are not currently on the based on the international ban according to the risks, and let's substitute market with less risky possibilities, let's say. One of the areas is, for example, that we can choose two. One is from medical means. We had a heroin epidemic about 15 years ago. Now it's almost gone. One of the main reasons is very easy access to lower risk substance, as you all know, called buprenorphine, which goes through every GP clinic. And what I'm arguing later, if we have a risk of fentanyl coming to Europe, we should even think of over-the-counter limited access to buprenorphine. And that played an important role of almost diminishing heroin issue in Czech Republic. I would like to stress, if you allow me to, two more minutes, few wealth kind of facts, yes? Today, we still have almost 3 million people out of 11 million from the prison population, 2.7 million people who are in prison because of drug offenses. More than half million people are imprisoned for simple possession, just possession of drugs for personal use. 40% executions worldwide are for drug offenses still today. It's around 1,000 people, 700 to 1,000 people every year sentenced to death. In some countries, the drug offenses are higher than child abuse or rape. So we have these harsh policies based on ideology of abstinence, but at the same time, as we all know, the problem is rising. In 1998, we said, world free of drugs, we can do it. By 2008, it doubled, and until today, it quadrupled. The illicit market today, as we see it, is a bigger threat than the substances and the health risk itself, because the money flowing from this market is so big. So it's exceeding any previous situation, and it's one of the three biggest areas in money laundering and money flowing to global terrorism, totalitarian states, you name it. And the last thing I want to mention, people dependent or addicted on drugs who are diagnosed with, according to the medical manual, are still put to prison, which, as we see it, is a clear breach of the human rights, and it's a human rights violation per se. So I think this is still happening today, and unless we radically call for change And unless we start naming it together, this will only continue. So let me point out at the end a council conclusion that was taken 2022 by the European Union, led through the Czech presidency. I put it in the chat, so I'm not sure if you can all access it. The council conclusion is human rights council conclusion on human rights based policy approach, drug policy approach 2022, where we also point out issues such as gender inequality in a situation of access to services, and of course, as I mentioned a minute ago, the situation with people who are actually users diagnosed with according to medical manual and have no access to substitutions. Necessary substitution or prescriptions criminalized for their own diagnosable situation. So I'm very glad that we gathered together like this, and I hope this conference will result in some very strong united voice to send the message for change.
That was Jindřich Vobral, a leading expert on drug use and the former national drug coordinator of the Czech Republic, speaking at a side event entitled Evidence and Science-Based Approaches in Drug Policy, HIV and Health, Good Practices and Windows of Opportunity, which was held July 17th during the High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development at the United Nations in New York. Let's hear one more presentation from that event. Catherine Cook is the Acting Executive Director of Harm Reduction International.
My name is Catherine Cook. I'm from Harm Reduction International, and I'm going to talk a bit about the global state of harm reduction to look at what is at stake in this changing funding and political landscape we're currently in, and to point to some critical actions required to protect harm reduction programs. Harm reduction is much broader than the provision of needle and syringe programs or opioid agonist therapies, but on the screen here, I'm showing figures on some of the core interventions that the World Health Organization, UNAIDS and UNODC recommend countries implement as part of their health responses. We've monitored at HRI, we've monitored the global state of harm reduction since 2008, and we've seen slow but steady increase in the number of countries introducing harm reduction in implementation and in their national policies. Governments have signed up to high-level targets and commitments on scaling up harm reduction and community-led responses and on decriminalization. Harm reduction is emphasized more than ever before in international commitments, and this is not by accident. This is because it is effective and cost-effective and a necessary component to reaching global health goals. Harm reduction is valued on paper, and many countries are implementing harm reduction. But we also look at harm reduction funding because budgets are the real value statements, as the previous speaker mentioned. In lower middle-income countries in particular, the availability of funding for harm reduction has always fallen far short. While the overall HIV response had a 26% funding gap, in 2022, harm reduction had a funding gap of 94%. Harm reduction is very reliant on donors, and it has become increasingly reliant on the Global Fund, which accounted for 73% of all donor funding for harm reduction in 2022, compared to just 31% in 2007. PEPFAR was the second largest donor in 2022, contributing 8% of donor investment in harm reduction. And we found 9 other donors, including the Robert Carr Fund, Open Society Foundations, and the Elton John AIDS Foundation, who provided 5% or less. In 2023 and 2024, there were hopeful indications that harm reduction funding was on the increase. Data from the Global Fund showed that allocations for needle and syringe programs had increased by over 50% between grant cycles. A recent study from funders concerned about AIDS found philanthropic HIV donors had increased funding for harm reduction by 21% between 2022 and 2023. And lastly, PEPFAR budget data for 2024 to 2025 showed that their harm reduction funding was set to more than double, reaching around 17 million. But as Anton has already outlined, the drastic changes following the US government pause and subsequent terminations in foreign aid contracts have had severe impacts on harm reduction and the wider infrastructure that it relies upon. There is a really real danger that our next assessment of the funding landscape will be really stark, as many institutions undergo prioritization and streamlining processes in 2025. The gains made and the lives saved through precious investment so far are now under threat and in some cases already tragically lost. Too few governments are using domestic budgets to fund harm reduction. Our tracking found 27 low and middle income countries with domestic funding for harm reduction in 2022, together accounting for around one third of all harm reduction funding that year. And yet, while harm reduction is facing its most profound moment of crisis, governments and donors spend vast amounts on punitive drug approaches around the world. Since the UNGAS on drugs in 2016, many in the harm reduction and drug policy sector have been calling for governments and donors to look critically at this spending and the evidence of a failed war on drugs and the damage this has caused, calling for a redirection of investments into drug responses rooted in communities, health and justice. It is not that there is no money to provide life-saving services to people that need them. It is just that it's been spent on punitive approaches that not only do not work to achieve their stated aim of reducing drug use, but also directly impede access to essential health services and stigmatize people. So within this changing landscape, what are the critical actions to take? Governments prioritizing harm reduction in their domestic budgets is the most sustainable option to avoid unnecessary deaths and achieve global health targets. This is a moment to spotlight domestic investment in harm reduction, to amplify the positive experiences, like we've heard from Switzerland and Czechia, where this has yielded health, social, and economic benefits, to draw attention to the evidence from all parts of the world that harm reduction is not only evidence-based and life-saving, also cost-effective and cost-saving. It is a wise investment. HIV sustainability plans must include harm reduction and community-led responses. Recent WHO guidance classifies harm reduction as tier one, meaning that it must be funded even in the face of resource constraints. But we must make sure that community and civil society organizations receive direct funding through social contracting, as they are the backbone of the response in many countries. As governments look at how to fill funding gaps, let's encourage frank dialogue on the benefits of decriminalization, including the economic benefits. The money is there. Vast amounts are spent on criminalization and imprisoning people who use drugs. This must be divested and invested in community health and justice. We also must look at the bigger picture. We must make a loud call for economic justice and to move away from a colonial aid system. We need to see debt cancellation and donors decolonizing their approaches. And we must be realists that the global health architecture is changing as aid is deprioritized in favor of military spend. We still need a fully funded global fund, and this will require governments and the philanthropic and private sector to step up with strong pledges later this year.
That was Catherine Cook, Acting Executive Director of Harm Reduction International, speaking at a side event entitled Evidence and Science-Based Approaches in Drug Policy, HIV and Health, Good Practices and Windows of Opportunity, which was held July 17th during the High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development at the United Nations in New York. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.